You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 260 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello, and we are sponsored, as usual, by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. So I would say normally we've got a lot to get to. We've got slightly less to get to this week because we talked about the NFL draft and the UW football spring game on our special episode earlier this week on Monday. So that covered a lot of ground. There's still plenty to get to, of course.
Oh, yeah. Look, we never are going to not get to any ground. We leave no ground uncovered. We're like every blade of grass for chatter.
At this point, transfers in college sports alone are like a full-time podcast. Just talking about UW comings and goings. So that'll come up, of course. Some exciting news on that front for the UW men's basketball team. But we start with our toasts, and we start with this week's beer, which is the Mexican Lager from Two Beers. Came out today as we record this on Tuesday. I think I may have been the very first person to get a six pack of this because they opened at noon and I was there at like 12:10 to pick up my pre-order since you were swinging by to pick it up.
This better be fresh.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Enjoyed by itself or with a slice of lime, it's light, sessionable, and crisp, perfectly suited for your taco night, your backyard barbecue, or a long, easy afternoon in the sun. For a limited time.
I really love the cans on this beer, the branding.
Yeah, there's a few different colors. You'll be able to see this, of course, on the Pelton Cast Instagram account if you're following that.
Oh, that's refreshing.
So stay tuned this week. I believe it's going to be the Pelton Cast MVP voting. The ballot presumably comes out this week. We've had a runoff. Let's Remember Some Years has narrowly defeated Awkward Pauses. And I don't know if you want to pause here in honor of that vote.
It's called drama. It's called building a moment here, people. Come on.
No, you are not getting a phone call. That was just us. All right, first off with our toasts, congrats to the Seattle Kraken, which officially became the NHL's 32nd team last week, submitting their final payment on the expansion fee. This means the Kraken can now sign amateur free agents and eventually make trades. One thing I learned, I'm still not 100% sure on this, but I went to go look this up. When can NHL teams start trading after the trade deadline? It appears there actually is no trade deadline in the NHL. It's just that players traded after that date aren't playoff eligible. So hypothetically, they could start making trades right now if that's correct.
Great.
You seem perplexed.
I'm not perplexed.
Okay.
I totally understand everything, all of the intricacies about the NHL trade deadline and salary cap.
Yeah, the NHL CBA. We're experts in that. We're pivoting to that. Congrats to UW soccer teams, both of whom advanced to the Sweet 16 over the weekend. The number 7 seed men's soccer beat Grand Canyon 2-0 on Sunday in their tournament opener and will now face Missouri State on Thursday. The unranked UW women beat Liberty 3-0 on Tuesday, followed by number 15 seed St. Louis on Friday via PKs. A thriller as the goalkeeper stepped up and delivered the winning PK.
Wow.
She was in the order, fifth in the order. Now face a tougher task, number 2 seed North Carolina on Wednesday. And that both those tournaments being played in North Carolina. Next up, congrats to Brianna Stewart, who shared her engagement to Phoenix Mercury guard Marta Jargay on social media over the weekend. A lot of engagements for the Storm this offseason.
She decided to do it. I'm looking at this photo wearing basketball shorts.
Yes. Both of them were pretty informal, although in this case, there was no bucket hat involved, as famously Megan Rapinoe was apparently wearing right before the photos were taken of their proposal. All right, lastly, in some sad news, Water Follies has been canceled for 2021.
No.
Citing Washington's guidelines for special events, which currently permit no more than 9,000 people at outdoor special events in phase 3. And it's kind of funny compared to last year, where even at the height of the pandemic, Water Volumes was like, well, we're just going to postpone it. We're not going to full on cancel it. So to cancel it now, when there does seem to be some sort of a finish line in sight, thanks to the vaccination process, is a little odd. But I think similar to Seafair, you just couldn't be sure that you would be able to do it.
This is devastating news for you, especially.
I mean, to go another summer without any unlimited hydroplane rates is in the state of Washington is tremendously disappointing.
And you know what else is going to be canceled? It's the Pelton cast. If there's no hydroplane talk, the weeks of Waterfalling and Seafairs, we're still going to release a podcast, but 45 minutes of dead air to honor the time that we would have been talking about those hydroplane races. That's right. That is commitment to excellence.
It'll all be one awkward pause. So you said this week you have another Coach's Corner story for us.
Wow, we're in it already. Jeez.
I think we're going to go straight to it.
Okay. Well, I wasn't prepared for that. So I explained last week that for Luca's baseball game, his first of the season, I was roped into bench coaching. This week, middle child Marco had literally his first ever baseball game. So I'm taking him to, I had a burp. That one. That was not a dramatic pause. Theater. So I'm taking him to his first ever baseball game. And these are kindergarten age players. So it is actually so much more compelling than older kids who do kid pitch, which is literally just ball, wild pitch. Ball gets thrown back to the pitcher and they lose it. Every single kid steps up to the plate, to the tee, and they just hit the ball immediately. It's kind of incredible. It's fun to watch. And also, every single player gets on base because there aren't any outs. So, first in the order is Marco for his first ever
baseball
game.
Leading off.
Okay. Lead off, man. Huge. Clearly, they had assessed his abilities in practice. It wasn't random at all.
High OBP they expected.
And so I get him all ready or whatever, like he's wearing his glasses and I'm shoving a helmet on top of his head. And so he goes up to the plate to hit. And then I basically just go stand on the field to watch him hit, as you do.
Ken like Griffey you were, Sr. like you were Jimmy Lake during the spring game.
Yeah. Yes. Ken Griffey Sr. did the same thing for Ken Griffey Jr. during his first at bat, huh. I think. Similar type of situation. So I'm standing basically like right next to the dugout on like the third baseline watching him hit. And then so he hits or whatever, gets on base because literally everybody gets on base. Just rip the ball. Amazing hit. And I actually have footage of his first ever baseball hit. And
I have seen the footage.
Oh, wow. You've seen the footage. So I'm standing there.
It was on Facebook.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. My banning Facebook means that, or protesting Facebook means that I miss a lot of stuff about my children. But so one of the coaches comes out and is talking to me or whatever after the hit. I'm standing there on the field and he's like, hey, actually. And I'm like, oh, okay. I thought he was going to be like, hey, actually, you can't really stand on the field. If you did that, every single parent would be out there. And I'm so prepared to be like, you know, sorry, I was just getting him ready. Just watching for a second. And then he's like, hey, actually, we need a third base coach if you want to coach that for the game.
There you go. Wow.
I told you, like, lost to a flame. I will be coaching every single child's sporting event, whether I want to or not. And then all of a sudden, when he asked me that, I'm like, hell yeah, I want a third
base
coach.
Now you're in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So there, he was like asking me and there was another dad nearby. He was like, if one of you guys, I was already standing there, so it made more sense, but I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And so kids are coming around and I'm like, hey, do you know which direction to run? Because literally the batter right after Marco, the second batter in the lineup, ran to third base instead of first. That's freaking pressure for a third base coach right there.
Yeah, that is something.
And then also telling the kids, being like, hey, when they hit it, run home. You know to do that, right? The last batter of every inning, if anybody's ever paid attention to kindergarten baseball, means that the hit is a home run. So everybody rounds the bases on the last hit. I'm out there waving people around like I'm Sam Perlazzo. You know what I mean? Like,
that was exactly the reference I was going for.
I was getting into it, waving those kids around the bases. And then every single inning that came up, they didn't change the order. So I'm like, yeah, I am. You can just call me Mr. Third Base Coach, right? I am out there to claim that role. So it begrudgingly again, nah, this one was a little bit less begrudgingly, unexpectedly, I became a coach of a child sporting event without volunteering for it in advance.
I like to think this is really just about the content. It's about making sure that we can have a truly accurately named Coach's Corner each week.
I was so ready to be like, for the dude to be like, hey, can you get off the field? And instead he was like, hey, can you stay on the field? Which doesn't happen that often.
Did not happen with the pitch invasion at Man United, I don't think. Is there an update on Luca? Does he have a batting average yet?
No. If we could keep a running tally of his, I would say, keep calling Billy Bean. That's right. He went 0-for-1 with a walk this week. So
he does have a batting average then.
Oh, I guess his batting average is 0. Yes.
Yes.
He has 4 plate appearances, 1 at bat. He's 0-for-1 and a 750 on base percentage. And I still consider that good.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I look forward to future Coach's Corner and updates. Is this going to be a permanent role for you as third base coach at Marcos Games?
If we're splitting up the children's games, I would much rather go to the kindergarten t-ball games. So I'm probably going to have to, because sometimes they're at the same time. So I may have to go down to Ravensdale again at some point in the future, which we've now nicknamed Roniesdale. And coach the massless teams that they play against. So,
oh dear.
We'll see.
Well, should we talk about fried chicken? And we're sort of continuing our search for Seattle's best fried chicken this week, but it's a little bit of an unorthodox week because we got to talk about something exciting that's happening this week. The opening of Taku. And I got to give at GoHuskies1978 on Twitter credit for giving me the push I needed to start watching Top Chef Portland this current season, season 18 of Top Chef. I had never watched Top Chef 1 minute in my life before this month, but, you know, came up on Twitter. People were very much encouraging me to watch. And the combination of the fact that we have a contestant, possibly one of the favorites from Seattle, and that it's set in Portland with that great culinary scene and all the shots of the Willamette River and the bridges crossing it. Like, it was too much for me not to watch. Now I feel like I need you to join me so we have something else to talk about and we can turn this into a Top Chef podcast.
I would like to.
That's a bad idea because there already is a great Top Chef podcast done by my friends and colleagues, Kevin Artovitz and Tom Haverstroh. Pack Your Knives, which I have now listened to every episode of this season as I've caught off on my Top Chef viewing. I'm no longer behind. So Shota Nakajima from Seattle, the number one pick in their Top Chef fantasy draft after the opening episode. So wow. a strong contender here.
I assume that's an honor.
I mean, it's the best you can possibly do in that.
Doesn't mean almost as much of an honor as being the Pelton Cast MVP.
I don't know. The Pelton Cast MVP. I don't know if Shota is going to be printing out the tweet and then giving it to the other Top Chef contestants as a Christmas gift. I cannot. But anyways, I'm already in. I'm already hooked. But let's talk about Shota, who opened Naka on Capitol Hill serving a fixed kaisuke menu in 2015 and then revamped it in 2017 as a Donna, providing a middle-end, more casual menu and found success with that. So he had that restaurant going successfully and then opened Taku as his second restaurant on March 10th, 2020.
Oh, no.
Which was not the best time, as it turned out, to open a restaurant. They were originally serving kushikatsu deep-fried skewers. Okay. And decided in May to temporarily close Taku and permanently close Adana, which is not reopening. And so then after filming Top Chef last fall is when they filmed it in Portland. Now reopening Taku and reimagining it, serving karaage, which is a generic term for marinated and lightly fried food in Japan, but traditionally most common with fried chicken. Basically, that's the Japanese version of fried chicken. And were you unfamiliar with this term?
don't want to say unfamiliar, but if you would have been like, what is karage? I don't know if I could have answered that question.
Well, now you know. So they've got nuggets is what they're calling the karage pieces. And they're probably on the big side for what I've had historically in terms of karage. There's also wings and a karage burger, which is a chicken sandwich. I don't know why they're calling it a burger, which I'm very curious to try that. But they officially open Wednesday, the day this podcast comes out, is the first day. But last week they were doing a few training days for the staff that they only posted about on Instagram. And I wanted to get down wet. There. not intentional at all. We did get the wet chicken, as it turns out, was one of our orders. So I made a point last Friday of getting down there and was very concerned that there was going to be a huge line. Like I drove by. So the location is, it's right next to the Sultan Straw in Capitol Hill.
There we go.
So that's going to be a pop-in location this summer for sure. I was concerned that there was going to be a huge line. Saw a bunch of people out front.
That's the Lines District of Capitol Hill now.
It is, yes.
We're going to call it Little Portland.
And thankfully, it turned out after I parked like five blocks away, because there was definitely not a lot of parking there. There was only like three people in line. Everyone was just waiting for their food, had already ordered. So it wasn't the long wait that I was fearing in line. And we got 10 of the nuggets of the Japanese curry style, which I was kind of expecting to be the strongest. And then five of the spicy teriyaki. I also got some fries, which were quite good, that I was able to enjoy while I was still waiting for the chicken.
Oh, they give you the fries right away?
Not right away, but before the chicken.
That's kind of a come up. So this is supposed to be sort of like drunk food, right? This is like
definitely
you're out late on Capitol Hill. And
I mean, not exclusively that. It's like Dick's, like something that's good for that, but also good at all times.
And the expectation is that it's going to be open late, though.
Yes.
And sort of be like Japanese-style street food.
Pretty much, yeah. And I mean, that was the idea previously with the skewers. But those turned out to be a little more difficult, I think, technically to accomplish. So, hence the pivot. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to consider this a full fried chicken review. Because number one, they weren't even officially open. They were just training. Like, that would be unfair to review them before their first day.
Yes.
And number two, it's semi-debatable whether this actually qualifies as Seattle's best fried chicken. I think that I come down on the answer of being yes. I don't know where you fall.
Absolutely
on
the answer. Well, they have wings too, which wings would qualify, I believe, right?
No.
Wings don't qualify.
Wings are a separate thing altogether.
Okay, so we did go to a location to Nana's Southern Kitchen, right? Which only does wings for their fried chicken. So you're going to tell me that Nana's Southern Kitchen is not included here?
It's a little borderline, in my opinion. Because there's a separate search for Seattle's best wing, and that's one we're going to do
different.
At some point.
The wings at Nana's Southern Kitchen are not, they're like fried chicken.
Yes. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, we're getting into chicken semantics here that we don't need to get into because the chicken's great. And I do think that this is a participant. I think they are eligible with the karage for Seattle's best fried chicken because spiritually, this is fried chicken.
Exactly.
And I think, look, I know fried chicken when I see it. And actually, I don't know if I do, but...
Very debatable.
I think more recently, I might know fried chicken when I see it. And this is fried chicken. And I think that's the most important aspect here is that in the same way that the Nana Southern Kitchen could be wings, but you know what wings are and you know what fried chicken is and you know the difference between the two.
Correct. Yes.
So and that's really what this is. So it's a unique contender for Seattle's best fried chicken. But also, I think structurally, the way that the curry chicken is, it's not all that different than the cookies necessarily. In like the cookies fried chicken, they were almost like kind of balls almost, you know, they were like, I think it was like a half breast, right? They're kind of strange size pieces.
I mean, I would say like physically it was closer to the place we went to in not one near the University District, which I'm forgetting the name of already.
Yes.
That was what it was physically most similar to
the Oyster House. Yeah.
Yeah. Frank's Oyster House. Yes. Yeah.
No, I agree with that also. So I think structurally it's very similar to some of the locations that we've been to. Flavor wise, it's definitely, it's a different flavor palette than we're going for.
Yeah. So
than we've previously had.
So the flavor options, there's salt and pepper, bonito and soy, and then the curry, those are dry rubs. And then teriyaki and spicy teriyaki are more like wet sauces, basically. So we went for one of each of those. And I would say the curry, I was very excited about. Big fan of Japanese curry. It smelled delicious. The flavor was a little more subtle, I think, in practice than I was expecting.
And it felt like it needed a sauce, to be honest, especially because there's no bone in there. It would have worked pretty naturally. It's almost like you dip it something into a sauce. And I think it could have been phenomenal if it had that. On its own, just needed a little bit stronger flavor. Again, they weren't even open yet as a business, though. And these are things that are going to get tightened up.
I mean, the other thing we should say, by the way, like, beautifully cooked, like, nice and juicy on the inside, crispy on the outside, exactly how you would want them to be cooked, which is, I think, a key part of the karaage process. But the spicy teriyaki, by contrast, that was up there with anything we've had in this search.
How did we not get more of the spicy teriyaki? How many of me do there need to be?
I don't know. It was a mistake, and one we will definitely rectify the next time we go.
I rectified it the first time.
You were the one, because you pushed for spicy teriyaki?
Well, of course. You say to me, spicy teriyaki. I say yes.
It is hard to go wrong with spicy teriyaki. I agree.
Have you learned nothing? And the spicy teriyaki was phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier the possibility of just kind of walking this into the bracket portion of this search for Seattle's best fried chicken. And I'd be okay with that.
Done.
All right. I mean, it's a contender. I'm curious to see like just how crowded it gets when this starts. The word is there was a big crowd. So they had a pop-up before these training periods where a couple of the other chefs from Chop Chef, I believe Byron and Sarah, also participated. So
you know them by their first names now.
Yeah, I'm on a first name basis with them.
Byron and Sarah. I'll be very fascinated. I think long term, I'm not anticipating that it's going to be a ridiculously long line all the time.
I mean, especially, you know, it's takeout only. You can order ahead online, so that may be the sneak. Yes,
there it is.
Yeah. The number one sneak was going before they were officially open, in my opinion.
Here's the sneak long term. See, this is the thing. I don't know if that counts as a sneak ordering ahead. Come on. But here's how it would be a sneak. Let's say that you're comfortable going to bars. Bars are open, whatever. COVID cases are low. And you're at a bar and you're like, I'm going to want this in 20 minutes. Being at the other bar that you're at drinking, ordering ahead, leaving from there, picking it up to go. That's a sneak right there.
Well, that is a sneak.
I literally just described an ordering ahead scenario.
or taking it to a beer bar, which is our primary sneak all along.
There's that like Red Hook beer bar, which is always really strange right there, right? I don't think I know a single person who has been inside the Red Hook Brew Lab.
And we went to that one random beer bar after we got Dick's one time and did a sneak.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fried chicken, for the first time since March 2020, I am planning to go to an NBA basketball game.
Wow.
On Friday, I'm planning to head down to Portland for Blazers Lakers. And that can mean only one thing. And that's I'm headed to Screen Door to try their fried chicken and officially rate it in the context of this search.
Wow, I'm so hype on this.
Not hype enough to go to Screen Door when you were in Portland, but you're hype for me to go there.
Yeah.
And exciting Screen Door news. We talked about this, I think, on the pod. They are, in fact, opening a second location in the Pearl District. It is opening a week from Wednesday, May 12th.
There we go.
If I'm down there for a play-in tournament, that will be an option.
Whoa.
The Blazers would be in the play-in if the season ended today.
You mispronounced Western Conference Finals.
Well, you get to one from the other. It is possible, I suppose. All right. Enough about food. Should we get to your favorite segment?
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariner's hot takes coming at you.
Well, I'm here to make an official declaration. I'm officially joining the bandwagon and becoming a Mariners fan.
Wow.
And no, it's not because of their hot start to the 21 season. Not at all. It's because of a Mariners super fan who I have no choice but to follow. That's right. Bernie Sanders.
There you go. You're feeling the burn.
He was spotted this last weekend hiking in Vermont while wearing a Mariners hat. And really, is there a better corollary for the Mariners than Bernie Sanders? This man doesn't win, but he fights the good fight. And he doesn't give up. And he pushes the rest of the team forward, much like the 2001 Mariners. Bernie had a big lead heading into the 2020 Democratic primaries. And did he win that nomination or the Mariners win the World Series? No, of course not. The rest of the field ganged up against them. But what came out of that? A more progressive agenda and a more progressive Major League Baseball. On Inauguration Day 2021, was Bernie Sanders elected president? No. But he won the day, this time in meme form. And the Mariners, do they win games? No, but they also win the day. In advertising, it's a light bat, gooey duck, Griffey for president. The Mariners and their new super fan Bernie know that sometimes the best way of winning is by losing.
not exactly win forever. I don't know. I feel like Bernie is still a lot more successful than the Mariners. I don't know if I want to go into who the presidential equivalent of the Mariners last two decades is, but I'm pretty sure it's a guy who used to own a sports team here. I think is the closest call.
That would be like, that's like the double A team that nobody is at. Nobody cares about. They don't, at least the Mariners are in the major league. He didn't even fucking run for president. Like they're in there. They're on the stage. You know what I mean?
They did get to the debates.
They cleared the point threshold to be on the debate stage. That's what the Mariners do.
The Mariners were also partially responsible for one of the most amazing things that's happened in baseball this season. Did you see this? That at one point last week, the AL West standings spelled out asshat.
Absolutely, I did. This is something that I missed.
I don't know. I'm not sure who's seeing this.
I've missed a lot of stuff, but I have not missed that the AL standings spelled out asshat. The AL standings.
Good. I'm glad you didn't.
I was so prepared for you to correct me on the Griffey for President being a Nike campaign and Mariners official.
None of these were actually Mariners campaigns. The other ones were whatever the local hardware, Eagle Hardware, right?
It's a light bat?
Yeah, that's an Eagle Hardware.
Wow. Eagle Hardware.
And I think the Gooey Duck one is them too.
That's the Mariners official one.
Is it?
Yes. That was pronouncing words with, I think, also Edgar Martinez. And there was Squim.
Yeah, definitely. No. Oh, I guess that was a Mariners ad. Yes, that's the only one that they actually
Eagle
produced.
Eagle Hardware?
You didn't mention Bernandez, Larry Bernandez.
Oh.
Which is also a favorite one. Yeah, light bat was definitely Eagle Hardware.
Is this place still exist?
No, I'm sure it's been subsumed into some chain.
Wow. Now that it no longer exists, it's my favorite location. It's the Montreal Expos of hardware stores.
I guess I can't dispute that.
R.I.P. Ernst.
R.I.P. Chubby and Tubby. We could do this all day. But instead, let's talk about the Sounders coming off a thrilling 3-0 win at home Sunday versus the LA Galaxy. The Sounders dominated the unbeaten Galaxy pretty much from start to finish.
How many matches is that, the unbeaten Galaxy?
Two. They were the last unbeaten team in at least the West, I think MLS. Getting a pair of goals in a three-minute span midway through the first half from Raul Ruiz Diaz. And for a second consecutive week, you cannot stop this man from scoring. Brad Smith scored again. Ruiz Diaz finished things off in style with a second goal in second half stoppage time for the final margin.
Brad Smith looks like friggin' Jason Statham now. I mean, like, who would want to stop him? He's scary out there.
Exactly. Nico Ladero made his first appearance of the season, returning from injury as a reserve in the 65th minute. And with Josh Atencio scratched due to a quad strain, Federal Way native Kellen Rowe, who's one of the players on the team, you were like, I've never heard of that person.
There were
like,
a lot, yeah.
He's, again, as usual, just pay like the slightest attention to these segments. Made his first start with the Sounders. Guymar Gomez Andrade also replaced Javier Arriaga as a starter at center back.
Is Federal Way the 253?
Yes, yes. They
you're,
were.
You're like, we named him the greatest athlete in 253 history. You I don't think even remember this.
I don't think we actually mentioned Kellen Rowe in that one.
Wow.
All right, coming up this Sunday for the Sounders, it's a derby match against the rival Portland Timbers in Portland at 12 noon on Sunday, high noon on ABC, which is televising some MLS matches this year.
We should just stick around in Portland, spend the weekend.
Yeah. We can't go to the game because they're not having fans there.
They don't even have notably. Press.
I'm sure they do have press. It's a busy week for the Timbers, who are in Mexico City right now to face Club America in the CONCACAF Champions League on Wednesday night before returning home. Those two teams drew 1-1 in Portland last Wednesday in the first leg of that matchup, with America scoring the equalizer on a penalty in the 97th minute.
Wow, brutal.
Yeah, tough break there. As I mentioned, will not be fans in attendance after Oregon Governor Kate Brown rejected an appeal by the Timbers and Thorns for matches this weekend. Although there was a report today from John Canzano that the Blazers will be allowed fans starting on Friday. So
really, you're kind of tough to square those. The first fans.
Yes, coincidentally, it would both be my first game and the fans' first game, if that isn't indeed accurate.
That is kind of fascinating because the other sporting events would be outdoors, which
It doesn't make any particular sense to me. I don't know. Oregon seems very behind in terms of attendance at sporting events. So Portland currently mired 12th in the West with one win from their first three matches, although that's definitely bad luck. Their expected goal differential is positive so far, according to American Soccer Analysis's expected goals.
And a three-game sample size in soccer really matters.
Yeah, definitely you take a lot from that. But it'll be interesting. They're going to have to play all the starters, presumably, on Wednesday. So that's a tight turnaround that the Sounders, not being in CONCACAF Champions League, do not have to worry about. OL Reign wrapped up the NWSL Challenge Cup on Monday, with a 2-1 win at Kansas City. Celia Jimenez Delgado broke a halftime tie with a headed corner in the 84th minute. The victory allowed the Reign to finish second in the West in the Challenge Cup standings behind the Portland Thorns, who will conclude the Challenge Cup this weekend by hosting Gotham FC on Saturday in the final. Reign have the weekend off along with the rest of the NWSL before the regular season begins the following weekend. Seattle Storm also working towards the opening of the season on May 15th. Big storyline this past week from training camp, the fact that they're probably going to be without multiple players for the start of the season. Epiphany Prince and Mercedes Russell, their team in Turkey, advanced to the finals, but needed five games in the semifinals to do it. So the earliest that series could wrap up is May 11th. And when you look at six-day mandatory quarantines after coming back to the U.S., obviously no way they could be available for the game on May 15th as a result of that. And then somewhat more troublingly, Kiki Herbert-Harrigan, one of the team's new additions this year, has been unable to enter the country as she's dealing with some visa issues right now. So Dan Hughes expressed more optimism today that that might get resolved, but no timetable for when she might be able to join the team. So a bit of a concern with now 11 days as we record this until the Storm opens the season against the Las Vegas Aces. Our UW softball, the Huskies were actually off last weekend. I misread the schedule when I mentioned that they were going to play Utah. One Pac-12 team has a bye each weekend because the conference has an odd number of teams in softball, despite being the Pac-12. Huskies, who dropped to number 5.
Wait, who doesn't play softball? Colorado?
I'd have to go look it up. I think they're one of them, yes.
What, there's more than one?
There's three teams. Only 12 teams play softball in the Pac-12.
Don't play softball. What about one of the Arizonas?
No, the Arizonas definitely do. It is Oregon Colorado. State. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. USC does not play softball, apparently. That's very odd.
They don't play softball?
Yeah. And Wazoo.
Wow.
So
I watched Top Gun earlier today. Actually, I watched the first 15 minutes of Top Gun earlier today.
I don't know where you're going with this, but I'm curious. Oh, I know. I do know where you're going.
The very beginning. God, giving new meaning to cooging it. Am I right? I think everybody else has learned this watching Top Gun in the previous 30 years. I don't think I've seen that movie since maybe the early 90s.
Wait, really? Not even when they did the rewatchables on it?
Oh my God. I'm freaking in instantly, right? When, oh my God, when they have the little, the thing about the describing the like group that they're part of and they call that dot, 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 and then boom, Top Gun. I'm just like, let's fucking go. Right? Like,
I don't know if you're aware of this.
More in at the beginning of a movie than I was for that.
I mean, they did that rewatchables and it was like, that was when they dropped the trailer for Top Gun Maverick, right? And that was the weekend before Seafair and before the Blue Angels. Like that's like the most hyped one can possibly get on and
one being like demonstration. ESPN's Kevin Pelton.
Yes, that was the royal one.
Should Illuminati hotties, this is a question for everybody out there, you and everybody out there,
for the
cover
listener.
Highway to the Danger Zone when the new Top Gun, when is that? Is that coming out this summer?
That's the plan. I'm ready to get vaccinated.
The week of release for that film, should Illuminati hotties release a cover of Highway to the Danger Zone?
Hell yes.
We've been teasing this idea for a long time.
Absolutely. A classic. Oh,
truly a classic.
I was listening
to it and I was like, Sarah has to do this.
So anyways, you get up softball. the Huskies do post last place Utah this weekend. The Utes slipped to 2-16 in conference play with a sweep by UCLA, but did limit the Bruins to 19 runs in the four games. So actually pretty impressive pitching by Utah. Not much from the Utes bats. All right, now we get to the transfer section of today's program. Starting with UW women's basketball, the Huskies announced that Rice center Nancy Mulkey will follow her coach Tina Langley to UW as a transfer. Mulkey opted to utilize her sixth year of eligibility after initially declaring for the WNBA draft. Listed at 6'9", Mulkey began her career at Oklahoma, starting 18 games as a freshman before transferring to Rice, where she was three-time Conference USA Defensive Player of the Year and MVP of the Owls 2021 WNIT win. In addition to her defense, also a high-volume scorer with good efficiency at Rice, the Owls, according to CBB Analytics, 18 points per 100 possessions better on both offense and defense.
Wow.
With Mulkey on the court.
A monster move, right?
Absolutely. I mean, she was one of the very best players to transfer in the entire country. So
huge.
You know, offsets the departures that they've had in terms of transfers and gives Tina Langley a much better chance of being competitive in year one at UW. Seattle Times also reported that Haley Van Dyke, the Huskies' leading scorer last season at 12 points per game, has withdrawn her notification of transfer and will remain at UW. So another win there for Tina Langley. All right, now let's get to UW men's basketball, which has been busy over the past week, making a bunch of news. We can toast to this. Husky legend Quincy Pondexter, named as the team's third assistant coach, joining fellow alum Will Conroy and fellow newcomer Wyking Jones.
This is for Coupon right here. Entering phase two of his career. I thought Coupon was still like an active NBA player, but
it's been a couple of years now.
Bring it on.
Yeah, no, very exciting to bring him back. And someone I think can relate to a lot of players given all the different roles he played over the course of his career. Highly touted recruit coming in as part of what was at the time, you know, his best recruiting class ever, with Spencer Hawes, Phil Nelson, Adrian Oliver. I don't know if there was a fifth guy in that group. Then, you know, kind of a role player his first couple of years at UW. Until then, it really clicked for him as an upperclassman, and he became one of the late career breakout players that we saw so often under Lorenzo Romar that really aren't a thing that exists in college basketball anymore because those guys have all transferred.
I mean, there are late career breakout players. They're just on other teams.
Right. And then a legitimate star in an NBA prospect who led the Huskies, scored the game-winning basket in the first round of the NCAA tournament against Marquette, one of the most thrilling Husky NCAA tournament wins ever.
It's definitely different. I mean, first-round draft pick, right? Like,
yeah.
Quincy Pondexter is different. His profile is different than Will Conroy's was. Will Conroy is a long-term professional basketball player, both in the NBA and overseas, but like Quincy Pondexter is an NBA player.
Correct.
And was an NBA player for a long period of time, and not a star necessarily, but like a name that I think a lot of young players will know and recognize. I think this is huge for him coming on with this. This is his first coaching job, right?
First formal coaching job. So he has been coaching at the AAU level with Cal United and Las Vegas Elite since 2015, the press release mentioned.
And, you know, I know you like to joke around about Mike Hopkins and his connection to Washington State. I understand that a lot of us don't think it's funny, but this is one thing that I will say that Mike Hopkins has done well, both keeping Will Conroy on the staff and now bringing in Quincy Pondexter. It is definitely noting UW's history, right? During the Romar time period when the program was the best it's ever been.
I mean, Cameron Dollar was an example of that too.
And bringing those people back into the program, I think is huge. And it's something that, you know, the coach is different than who Quincy Pondexter played under, but the program is the same. So I think that's pretty huge that he was willing to do that.
Yeah. So Tuesday, we learned the Huskies will be welcoming back Garfield High product Dejon Davis.
There we go.
Part of Lorenzo Romar's last recruiting class before deciding to decommit after the coaching change and sign with Stanford.
Wow.
Davis played 4 years for the Cardinals starting in 97.
Can you imagine being so upset about a coaching change that you go to Stanford? Oh my God.
It's a beautiful campus. Great weather. Starting 97 of his 104 games at Stanford, Davis dealt with injuries last season and played just four games between December 6th and February 18th, and then returned primarily as a reserve as Stanford turned to freshman Michael O'Connell at the point, and Davis then subsequently decided to transfer to utilize his extra year of eligibility.
That is, I just don't even know. That's the worst breakup that anybody's ever suffered. I mean, to go to Stanford for 4 years.
Your hatred for Stanford is so deep. You're like, at least you could have gone to Cal.
I mean, really, absolutely. Fuck, I'd give up everything to go to Berkeley for a while. But is Dejon Davis good? What does this mean? Tell us what this means.
He's good. I think that, you know, he didn't quite develop as much as you would have hoped in many ways. His freshman season was in some ways his best season, I think. And his efficiency really suffered his sophomore and junior years, but bounced back last year. You know, one of the interesting things is he came in as more of a strictly a point guard, then ended up playing a lot more off the ball because his junior year, 2 years ago, they had Tyrell Terry, who was a second round pick by the Mavericks. And then last year, like I mentioned, O'Connell running the point a lot. And then Zaire Williams playing as something of a point forward too. So, you know, he's kind of gotten more experience off ball. And I think that's going to be meaningful because you look at this UW backcourt with him and Trail Brown Jr., another Garfield product. It's going to be kind of interchangeable, I think, with those two guys when they play on the court together. So,
okay. Read through the next bit of news. And then I want to ask some more general questions.
Okay. Huskies got a commit from JC recruit Langston Wilson, who is a fascinating story. Wilson was not cleared to play high school basketball in the Philadelphia area due to concerns over possible Marfan syndrome. Marfan syndrome is a genetic disorder that affects the connective tissue, and it's associated with heart issues that can make strenuous exertion more dangerous. Doctors suspect Wilson's father, Ron, has Marfan after a series of heart issues in 2010, a decade plus after Ron played center at Villanova. After high school, Langston Wilson's cardiologist indicated that the expected deterioration of the aorta related to this had not occurred and cleared Wilson to play basketball. He ended up at Georgia Highlands College and emerged as a high major recruit. He had committed to Alabama in November, but asked out of his commitment last month with the team over the scholarship limit. Wilson's an athletic 6'9", 210-pound forward who will have 3 years of eligibility because this last year, much like at the NCAA level, did not count as a year of eligibility.
So he'll be able to play for two or three different teams during that time.
Quite possibly, yes.
What is the deal? This was one that came so completely out of nowhere. And I think it's one of those things that when judging college basketball right now, there's so much movement happening within these programs that you know, obviously we saw a pretty massive exodus from the UW program. And I'm curious if some of that, obviously some of it was choice. I think that there are players that Mike Hopkins would have liked to have had back who are not going to come back next year. But also there were clearly some plans to bring in players via transfers. And you look at, I mean, this is one of the most fascinating transfers of almost anybody in the country, because it is such, Langston Wilson is such a blank slate and seems like there's a lot of talent there.
Yeah, and seems like an ideal fit for a zone system, is someone who's got a lot of, you know, size and length and athleticism, and, you know, mid not a lot of high level basketball experience, because the 2 years of junior college basketball are always played since middle school. So
that's wild.
You know, I think you stick him in the middle of the zone and tell him block shots, and that's probably an ideal way of using him. So, you know, the Huskies are going to be pretty front court heavy. They'll probably have to use him primarily as a power forward, but he'll definitely play a role in terms of helping to protect the rim on the back line, and, you know, has that ideal size and length you'd like to get out to the corners too in the 2-3 Syracuse style zone.
Do we anticipate that Langston Wilson will be starting right away, or is it such a blank slate that we just have no idea going into? They might not even know until they see him play basketball.
Right. And I think there's a lot of different ways they can go now. So, you know, let's look at where the roster is now. I don't know that it's set, but you've got 11 guys now as part of the team. You've got at least a rotation at the very least. So in the backcourt, you've got Brown and Dejon Davis, the two transfers. Then Dominic Penn, who signed last season and joined the team, but didn't see any action. And is another point guard is in the mix there. And then on the wing, in addition to, you know, the guards, you've got Jamal Bey, obviously, who I think will play both shooting guard and small forward next year. Cole Bajima, one of the few returning players from last year. And then Samuel Ariyibi, the NBA Africa Academy product, who is one of this year's two incoming freshman recruits. So then you've got Emmett Matthews Jr., the transfer from West Virginia. He might start at power forward. He could start at small forward.
I don't even remember all these transfers. Terrell Brown is from
Arizona, previously played at Seattle U.
Okay.
So I think those are probably the two big options. Are you going to start all four of those perimeter players, or are you going to only start three of them and then start Langston Wilson as power forward next to them? Those are the two most likely combinations, I think, you know, projecting way ahead at this point. So, you know, he's the other option at power forward. And then you got a deep center rotation with incoming freshman Jackson Grant, Nate Roberts, and Riley Sorn coming back from last year's team. So it's interesting. I mean, I definitely think the Huskies have gotten better. If you look at it in terms of the win shares for the guys they brought in as transfers, those guys combined for 5 win shares last season, even though Dejon Davis missed an extended period due to injury. These 7 players, or these 6 players who transferred out, combined for 1.3 win shares last season. I mean, obviously there weren't a lot to go around when you go
for
16
so many shares of the one win.
Exactly.
Jackson Grant, also highly recruited center.
Top 100 recruit. Yeah.
This looks like a good team to me. Am I wrong here? Does this look like a top half of the Pac-12 potentially competing for the NCAA tournament team? Because that's I'm seeing. Is this too rosy?
I think that's a little too rosy. I mean, I think there are two concerns. Number one, you didn't necessarily add a lot of shooting. The 3 incoming transfers.
No, Mike Hopkins does not believe in that.
I mean, the guys who transferred out combined for 109 threes last year, 37 of them from Eric Stevenson, 27 from Marcus Sonis. Now, they shot him at 30%, which is not great, but they made a lot, did take and make a lot of them. The 3 guys who are transferring in combined for 43 three-pointers last season. And it's definitely, like, if you look at the weakest part of all of their game, it's outside shooting. So
Dejon Davis is, like, significantly older than some of the players he's going to be playing against, though.
Correct. And the other question, I think, is whether there's that true go-to star offensively. Because there's a lot of solid players now. There's a baseline level of competence, to take a phrase from the Pack Your Knives podcast.
Baseline level of confidence, which did not exist last year.
Yes, but there's not necessarily the guy. I don't know who that would be. In some ways, Marcus Sonis, I think, had a better chance of being the guy than anybody.
And
I'm not sure where he ended up. The other thing, you know, you'd wonder about, like, long term, Matthews is the only one of these transfers who has more than 1 year of eligibility remaining. So that's a little bit of a concern when you lost several younger players. Oh, Sonis went to VCU, which is a really interesting landing spot.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's not exactly a way to build a program. You know, the addition of REB and Jackson Grant.
I don't know what that means, though. Like, are there places that are built, quote unquote, building programs?
It's much more difficult to do now than it ever has been before.
I just don't think if there were a bunch of freshmen coming in, you'd be like, all of these players are going to transfer if they don't play right away.
Yep. Yep.
So I just don't, I don't believe in the concept of building a program in college basketball anymore.
Maybe not. We'll see.
I think you get lucky one time. You get lucky one time with a winning season, and then you hope to get further and further transfers.
And there could be more in store. We'll see. The Huskies do have some scholarships left to offer. All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks. Some additional news since the draft, above and beyond the draft. Most notably that they are reportedly declining the fifth-year option on Rashad Penny's rookie contract. Not really surprising, as it would have guaranteed Penny $4.5 million in 2022, which is the same as Chris Carson's base salary as part of his new contract. Carson also has a 425K roster bonus. And Carson obviously far more accomplished at this point of his career than Rashad Penny. The new NFL collective bargaining agreement made this system a little more favorable to drafting running backs in the first round by basing the fifth-year option on essentially the average salary for starters at the position. So that $4.5 million is the lowest among all 2018 first-round picks, along with fellow running back Sony Michel.
It's just like a god.
Yeah. But it also made the salary fully guaranteed rather than just guaranteed for injury. So that's a bit of a, makes it a bit more difficult to pick up that option.
But it adds to the insult. Like, really, the lowest positional value is just like, yeah, you fucked up by making this pick. So you don't have to pay them as much money. You made a mistake. We understand. Teams are still doing it.
But I mean, one of the biggest criticisms, I think, that was completely valid, above and beyond the fact that it's easy to find running backs of similar ability later in the draft or undrafted, is also that, like, when you drafted a running back in the first round, you know, you were paying them at the top of the running back market on their rookie contract a lot of the time. And that wasn't really the case for Rashad Penny here, where, again, his fifth year with a raise would have been in the middle of the back market. If Rashad Penny had been the player the Seahawks hoped he would be, and obviously the ACL injury was a factor in that, then I don't think this would be a bad, you know, salary at which to have him.
The player that they hoped he would have been maybe push their seventh round draft pick running back out of a starting position. I don't really know what you're saying here.
It was a bad pick, but I'm saying it, like, in the, under the old system, I think the option would have been like $6 or $7 million. I mean, I'm just
okay,
going off
also,
the top of my head.
What you're saying is the money is lower and they still didn't pick up that option.
Well, yeah, because Rashad Penny has not been the player they expected, in large part because of the injury. So, Rashad Penny was not taking a running back in the first round, not Rashad Penny specifically, was a bad idea. It was a poor use of resources. But the fact that they didn't,
Earl Thomas instead.
The fact that they didn't pick up this option is not necessarily an indictment of, you know, the pick in and of itself.
You should have been indicting the pick the day it happened and then every single day since then.
I think we have been. I don't think there's any shortage of that.
I like Rashad Penny. It's unfair because I do think that Rashad Penny, in as much as there's running back skill, probably would be a good running back.
So we also didn't discuss the Seahawks signing defensive tackle Robert Kimdichi last week, which was timely. Because if you go back to the 2016 draft, there was a lot of excitement about Kimdichi. Yeah. When the Seahawks traded down and eventually took Jermaine Ifedi, two picks after Kimdichi went to the Arizona Cardinals. And that did not work out. He was waived by the Cardinals in 2019 with a failed physical designation and signed with the Dolphins before being out of the league entirely last season. Kimdichi had 4.5 sacks in 2018 when he started a career-high 6 of his 10 games. Otherwise, completely unproductive in his NFL career.
This is one where I mean, I guess whatever. Great. Seahawks side, Robert Kambici. He'll be somebody to push them in practice. It's exactly the type of player they like to sign. But if we could go back to the conversation we were having on Sunday about draft grades and trying to project individual players, I guarantee you in that draft that there were many pundits who love this pick. They felt like this was one of the steals of the draft. And you look at it years later, and now the Seahawks are signing him for the veteran minimum at this point, deep into free agency.
Yeah, I mean, he's an afterthought at best.
And it's just, you can't do it. You cannot do it with the draft. You cannot take any individual player in any round and say, that one player is going to be a great player. This is the steal. And I think this is a perfect example of that.
I don't know, I'm looking at some grades. The PFF gave them a C- for the grade for that draft.
For the draft in general or for that pick?
For the draft in general.
Who else did they draft?
Yeah, they seem to be more negative about their rest of their picks. I'm looking at Robert Kimdichi's steal of the draft. I'm not seeing there was an ESPN video clip here. Okay. So.
I mean, I think he was a highly touted player coming out of high school.
I mean, yeah, he was maybe like the best recruit in the country coming out of high school.
And that's the exact type of thing that maybe he didn't quite play as well on the field as they would have liked, but that's the exact type of player who gets kind of hyped up, especially in this round.
Yeah, I mean, fans are always excited about that type of player. I don't know if media is as excited as you think they were, especially because, you know, there was a lot of anonymous personnel people raising questions about his off-field issues as the reason he was dropping in the draft.
Oh, I love anonymous personnel people.
Yes.
My favorite.
All right, lastly on the Seahawks
front. Taysom Hill for some reason.
Lastly on the Seahawks front, DK Metcalf participating in the USA Track and Field Golden Games and Distance Open this Sunday, running the 100-meter dash.
Wow.
The event being held in the San Gabriel Valley with 200-meter heats will be televised on NBC starting at 1:30 Pacific. This is like a legit track meet. Like, their Olympians are going to be a part of this. And then also DK Metcalf, who could hypothetically qualify for the U.S. Olympic trials if he runs fast enough.
Wow. Men will literally participate in the USA Track and Field Golden Games and Distance Open this Sunday instead of going to therapy or dealing with their issues with Pete Carroll.
I mean, it's not Russell Wilson who's running this. I don't know that DK has issues right now.
We saw him postseason on that the conversation that he was having with who is that receiver?
Brandon Marshall. I mean, I think DK is just like, hey, I'm fast. I want to show everyone how fast I am. I mean, that's fun. Hopefully it goes well. But not too well, because the Olympic trials could mess up training camp.
I'm not too worried about it.
I don't think he's that effective as a sprinter against people who have been doing this their entire lives. He apparently ran the hurdles in high school. Was not a flat out sprinter back then. So we'll find out just how fast he is. We've seen this the opposite way with I can't remember which of the baits the Seahawks had, Michael or Mario, who was in the Olympics and then signed with the Seahawks subsequently. We seem to have no interest in this.
I have no other thoughts. I had my one statement. I've read my prepared statement.
Well, I guess on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.